For the final segment of the program, Dr. Grothy and then Dr. Goldberg make summary comments about the other presentations and discussions in the program, beginning with Dr. Grothy, who commented on Dr. Haller's topic, oxaliplatin as part of neoadjuvant therapy of rectal cancer.
I think it's actually interesting that the audience apparently was more kind of forward-thinking than our clinical trial results have kept up with, because so far we do not yet have validation in a phase 3 level that oxaliplatin should or can be used actually in the adjuvant setting, in the neoadjuvant setting for rectal cancer. Having said that, I think the answers also reflect that a lot of oncologists have already done what was asked, meaning integrating oxaliplatin early on into neoadjuvant therapy. And apparently they would do it again because they voted with their feet for, yes, in select patients, we can do that. And to be honest, I've done it in select patients out of clinical trials because it makes a lot of sense. And we have an abundance of phase 2 data showing that this is a tolerable, feasible way to deliver more intense chemotherapy early on with a regimen that, in addition to being a good radiosensitization regimen, also has systemic effect, which then can presumably kill micrometastases early enough to allow for a better overall outcome. There's a lot of hypotheses which we put into this thinking, but what we do see is that all phase 2 trials so far have shown that the PATH-CR rate after 5-FU or capecitabine plus oxaliplatin doubles compared to just 5-FU. Now it's in the range of about 20%. So I think there is evidence that we can do it. I've done it outside of a clinical trial, and I was actually surprised and happily surprised to see that our colleagues have embraced that. That doesn't take anything away from the fact that we need to validate the strategy in a phase 3 trial, and this is what's going to happen, what is happening right now.
And I guess certainly the way the question was worded, it was not that this is the usual therapy, but that this might be considered.
In select patients.
Right. And correct. What I've heard people talk the most about is the, quote, younger patient with a particularly bulky tumor. Is that where you think about it also?
Yeah, younger patients, bulky tumor, where you try to shoot for a good local response and sphincter preservation, potentially sphincter preservation. You also think that younger patients might be able to tolerate the increased side effect profile. Just at ASCO GI, we saw some data, randomized data, 5-FU plus radiation versus 5-FU oxaliplatin plus radiation from a northern Italian group, which did indicate, yes, there is a high rate of diarrhea and there's more neurotoxicity related to oxaliplatin. So it is more toxic in some ways, but apparently manageable, and patients were able to move on to surgery without time delays. So yes, I think the evidence is mounting that we can do it. The question is where to do it, younger patients, bulky tumors, or, and I mentioned that at the meeting, I have patients where, young patients where we have a stage 4, limited stage 4 situation, where a solitary liver metastasis, easily resectable, still provides a curative chance for patients. And in those patients, I like to use a combination therapy as upfront therapy.
Any situation where you think it would be reasonable to add in a biologic in the neoadjuvant setting? Of course, this is being studied, particularly in terms of bevacizumab.
Yeah, not yet. It makes a lot of sense, at least theoretically, to add cetuximab, bevacizumab to the mix based on, let's say, small trials, phase 1, 2, or even the large trials that led to the approval of cetuximab in head and neck cancer as a radiosensitizer. But I think in rectal cancer, we need to wait. It's a very delicate area to radiate and to give biologics at the same time. We can talk about potential high risk of bowel perforation on bevacizumab. We can talk about skin toxicities and nerve damage in the conjunction with oxaliplatin to pelvic structures. So I think outside of clinical trials, clear no to the use of biologic therapies right now.
So the next topic and discussion was by Alan Vanuk on the safety with the use of bevacizumab. And the question that we posed to the audience was, with informed patient consent, it is reasonable to use bevacizumab for patients with metastatic disease who've experienced a recent arterial event, and we define that within 6 months. And here we're trying to get into the trade-off between wanting to palliate the patient's tumor and the fear that we have about an arterial event. And actually, most of the participants, more than two-thirds, disagreed with that and wouldn't be comfortable doing that. A small fraction, about 20%, would. What are your thoughts about it?
again, as you mentioned, it is a trade-off between what we'd like to see in terms of efficacy and what we're willing to pay for it in terms of risk. And a patient who just recently, and recent is within 6 months, had an arterial event is at higher risk for another complication on bevacizumab. There is no question. We might be able to lower this risk by using anticoagulation, aspirin as a platelet and aggregation inhibitor, Plavix, or Coumadin, for instance. But overall, I think the majority of the audience voted rightfully so to be on the safe side of therapy. I can give you an example. I had a patient who came to me about 2 years ago in the initial time when bevacizumab just got approved or had limited experience with it. And he'd done a lot of research on his therapy for his metastatic colorectal cancer. And he came to my office saying, I want bevacizumab. I want this drug. And he had a partial phase paralysis, just had a stroke 2 days ago. I could hardly convince him that this was not an appropriate way for him to be treated. First of all, we waited for 6 weeks, then started on FOLFOX. He responded very well. If bevacizumab was the only drug that worked in colorectal cancer, we'd probably be more aggressive in using it. But we have a lot of alternatives, like FOLFOX, like FOLFIRI, like using EGF receptor inhibitors. I don't think we need to put patient at risk unnecessarily in this situation.
What about the patient whom you're going for cure, or the patient who has advanced stage disease and very symptomatic? I mean, is there a clinical situation where, you know, the concerns about the tumor would override this risk?
Not in the sense that if you talk about a symptomatic patient where response rate, induction of response is your main goal. Because from my understanding, the strength of bevacizumab is more delaying tumor progression than induction of response. If you really want a strong response inducer, you can combine combination therapy with an EGF receptor inhibitor, for which we have phase 2 data at least, randomized phase 2 data from Ellen Vanuk's presentation. If you want to shoot for a response rate, yes, you can do that. Again, there is an analysis and kind of elaborating a little bit about this and looking at it from a different side. We know that patients are at particular risk for these arterial events when they're over 65 years old and when they had a prior history of ATEs, these arterial events. When we now look back at this particular group of patients, elderly patients with a history of prior ATEs, in the pivotal Hurwitz trial, which led to the approval of bevacizumab, those patients, although they're at higher risk, show the same benefit in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival as the patients that are at low risk for these arterial events. It doesn't mean that this would allow us to uncritically use the drug in these patients, keeping in mind that patients with a recent cardiovascular event were excluded from the clinical trial. But overall, and this is something that I kind of balance back and forth when I talk to elderly patients without further risk for an arterial event, when we talk about stroke and heart attack, which raises flags for all patients, I tell them, you know, but overall, without any further risk factors, and if we put you on aspirin and you don't have a recent cardiovascular event, I feel comfortable putting you on this drug. So elderly patients can be treated. They still have a high risk, but they benefit.
Do we know anything more about what the mechanism is of why we see an increased incidence of arterial events with Bev?
You know, a lot of theories about, again, injuries to vascular structures, not being able to repair vascular injuries. There's the question of whether hypertension might play a role, which, according to our analysis, is not necessarily the case. To my knowledge, there's nothing definitive that could really explain what's going on.
And are we any closer to getting a little bit more refined now than just saying, well, an event within 6 months and over age 65 in terms of being more specific about the type of event or maybe a year versus 3 months or the age?
Yeah, it is interesting because what we're trying to do right now is getting these exactly those data out of the BRIGHT registry, which is a large observational study which captured 2,000 patient histories and patient treatment patterns with bevacizumab prospectively. And according to BRIGHT, interestingly though, the risk of arterial events is actually lower than was published in the pooled analysis. Although this BRIGHT registry also allows patients to enter this registry that are not necessarily candidates for clinical trials, so it's a less selected group of patients. So I don't want to diminish and kind of downplay this risk of arterial events because it is there, and for legal purposes and all, and taking care of our patients, we have to be very careful how we phrase these issues. But the BRIGHT trial, the BRIGHT registry will allow us to get a better understanding of what's going on when we follow patients long term. So far, what we know is that the majority of events happen within the first 2 to 3 months. Having said that, patients are still at risk even after a year or so to develop ATEs at a higher frequency than patients without bevacizumab. But there seems to be an initial kind of higher incidence followed by some plateauing and slow decrease of the risk overall. Again, this will need to be validated even in future analysis. The BRIGHT trial has now been replaced by an even larger registry, the ARIES trial, which will capture a patient with colon cancer and lung cancer treated with bevacizumab. And as soon as bevacizumab gets approved for breast cancer, we'll include those patients too. So overall, we'll be able to capture another 4,000 to 6,000 patient treatment algorithms, side effects, outcomes, etc. And then we'll have a strong base to really say, okay, it's about 1% of ATEs are related to myocardial infarction, 10% are stroke, they happen at this time. And I think it would be very helpful for us for our discussion with patients if we had these data right now.
I want to ask you about the next question and presentation from Norm Walmark looking at primary colon cancer presenting with metastatic disease. And here's the question we asked the audience. As you know, the NSABP is doing a study looking at these patients, C10. It's a straight phase 2 study, which is looking at FOLFOX bevacizumab in these patients. And the question we asked the audience was, for asymptomatic patients presenting with primary colon cancer or metastatic disease, the management strategy of choice is enrollment into the NSABP C10 study. And interestingly, more than half of the audience agreed with that statement. How would you respond to it, and what are your thoughts about these responses?
And when Norm Walmark is on the podium, of course you have to agree with him. I mean, there's no question about that. So of course you vote for that. But I think the question is more like, would you be willing to treat a patient with intact primary with primary chemotherapy,
right,
and not shoot for a surgery right away? I mean, this is the, I think, apart from the clinical trial question that occurs a lot in clinical practice. And I think we've seen a change in our attitude over the last 5 years because we've become more convinced about the efficacy of our chemotherapy, not only on metastasis, but also on the primary tumor, so that we are more willing to accept, let's say, chemotherapy as the first line treatment in the management of metastatic colon cancer in a patient where the tumor is asymptomatic otherwise, doesn't bleed, doesn't have any obstruction, etc. Actually, this can be taken to the extent that our gastroenterologists right now, our surgeons, they place stents in the primary tumor when they fear pending obstruction in the conjunction of extensive liver metastasis and send the patient to chemotherapy first. I have to admit that this is one of two patients that I had seen with GI perforation on bevacizumab who presented with a sigmoid stent and perfed at the stent site on bevacizumab, one of two, a young patient, no other complicating factors. So there's still a question mark on that for obstructing tumors. But if a patient presents to me nowadays with, let's say, non-obstructing, non-bleeding tumor or minimally bleeding tumor where the metastases dominate the clinical situation and the outcome, I opt for a systemic chemotherapy right up front.
What have you personally seen in terms of responses in the primary?
Very interesting question. I recently had a patient where a surgeon approached me in the hallway of Mayo Clinic saying, what did you do to this patient? Because, you know, surgeons always think they're the only ones who can deal with a primary tumor. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you know, this patient had a colon ascendens tumor. We scoped him, and yes, there it was. And then he had liver metastasis, and you treated him with FOLFOX bevacizumab. Then he underwent resection of his liver metastasis in a neoadjuvant treatment option. And of course, at the same time, they tried to resect the primary tumor. They did the resection, but there was a PATH-CR in the specimen, so they couldn't find the primary tumor anymore. Pathologic CR, which I think is very instrumental in our thinking, because the old belief that primary tumors don't respond to treatment just doesn't hold up.
Let's go on to the next topic, which Rich Goldberg talked about, which relates to the issue of chemotherapy in older patients, which he presented on at the last ASCO meeting. And the question that we asked the audience to respond to was, in general, for otherwise healthy patients of any age, even for those in their 70s or 80s, if adjuvant chemotherapy is to be used, it should include oxaliplatin. And more than half of the audience agreed with that. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm again happy and see that the audience, the ones who participated in the meeting, were actually quite knowledgeable because they based their decision on the presented and published data of Rich Goldberg's analysis, Dan Sargent's analysis, a pooled analysis of FOLFOX-based trials in the adjuvant and palliative setting, which showed that patients who are elderly over 70 years of age have the same benefit from treatment, palliative and adjuvant, as well as almost the same toxicity levels. Having said that, I mean, this only relates to patients who are considered candidates for these clinical trials. Secondly, some of these trials actually had a cutoff at 75. So we might have data on the patient group which were eligible for clinical trials from 70 to 75. But the patients over 80, I think that might be a different group of patients where we might have to follow a slightly more careful approach. As a guideline for adjuvant therapy, I agree 100%. Age should not be the dominating factor to decide on whether or not a patient receives adjuvant therapy and what kind of adjuvant therapy. So we should give them the best treatment we have, which as of now is an oxaliplatin-based regimen. We might diverge from this global guideline, overall guideline, when we see a more frail patient, etc. So age alone does not tell the whole story.
You know, I was really stunned because, you know, one of the audience members using the computer system submitted a question about a 92-year-old patient being considered for adjuvant therapy. And the sentiment came out, I think, that Rich expressed specifically that he'd consider using FOLFOX in a patient like that. And, you know, it reminds me of the fact that in breast cancer, the oncologists are very used to using Peter Rabdin's adjuvant online. And as you dial up the age, the absolute benefit of therapy decreases. And they look at those numbers. And I don't think people utilize that model as much in colon cancer. But if you look at it, you know, theoretically on paper, you know, it really does significantly diminish the absolute benefits. Do you think that that is the way it should be translated to practice? Because you see a big diversity, I think, in colon and breast from that point of view.
Yeah. I think you're talking about the competing reasons for death, you know, which, of course, the older you are, the more likely you are to die of natural causes anyway. And this also shows us it's not one-size-fits-all type of thinking. You know, we can't just apply everything we learn in younger patient population in clinical trials to every single patient out there. What's important is the right mindset. And the right mindset, as demonstrated by the audience, is age is not the dominating factor that will tell us what we should do. And I think we all know those patients who are 80 years old and who are perfectly healthy and perfectly fit. And we know these 55-year-old patients who might not be good candidates at all for comorbidities, et cetera, et cetera. Might not even be candidates for the clinical trials. We also have to realize a patient who's 80 years old has a median life expectancy, a female patient, of another 8 years. So 50% of all patients who show up at the age of 80 have a natural lifespan of 88 years. And for those patients, their risk for recurrence and dying of colon cancer is substantial and can be the life-limiting factor.
I think another thing that was brought out at the meeting was the issue of, well, maybe you won't affect survival, but you can delay or prevent relapse. And from a quality of life point of view, that maybe that's worth it, particularly given the fact that, you know, FOLFOX in the healthy older patients seems to be pretty well tolerated.
Yeah. I mean, this relates back to a discussion we have in breast cancer, like what do we really do with adjuvant therapy? Are we curing patients? Are we delaying tumor recurrence, which is not easy to dissect? You know, it takes long years to see whether survival curves actually trend together after some time. And for an elderly patient, it might not matter. And so delaying tumor recurrence, kind of preventing the situation of palliative therapy, which is presumably more toxic and more physically and psychologically difficult for patients, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
The next topic was presented by Neil Maripol and actually relates to what we're just talking about. The question of whether or not patients without high risk factors with stage 2 disease should have chemo discussed with them. And the audience is really split 50-50 in this right down the line. What are your thoughts?
I do agree that all patients with stage 2 disease should see a medical oncologist. I do think so, because we might even have trials for them to offer. We can include patients in clinical trials. We have several ongoing clinical trials for stage 2 patients, which already indicates it's a gray zone, because we randomize some of these patients to treatment or no treatment. So, in fact, it's probably the most debated topic right now in the area of colorectal cancer. How should we handle stage 2 patients? You can talk a lot about clinical trials. Yes, we know for an unselect group of patients with stage 2 disease, there is a slight but clearly visible survival benefit, even based on the British QUASAR data, which looked at let's say 92% of these patients that were enrolled in this trial had stage 2, meaning Duke's B disease, unselected, and they showed a 3% benefit in overall survival, absolute benefit, when they received 5-FU in whatever flavor. So 3% increase in overall survival is kind of the ballpark what we're talking about in unselect group of patients. And you are one of the pivotal thinkers and investigators on these issues is, what do patients really want? And if we are willing to subject patients with breast cancer for a much smaller benefit to sometimes more aggressive therapies, we're sometimes hesitant to really apply the same way of thinking to colon cancer patients. And as you've pointed out in your own analysis, which you presented at ASCO GI, that there's a substantial number of patients that will actually go through even FOLFOX-based adjuvant chemotherapy for potentially even smaller benefit in the adjuvant setting, less than the 3% which was demonstrated to be true for stage 2 patients. I think when we have to discuss this with patients, and this is not just hiding behind a patient's wish and avoiding a clear-cut decision by an oncologist, but it's really because the data are not that easy. Having said that, if in my personal practice, again, when I try to summarize everything that I know from clinical trials, from the MOSAIC trial, from the QUASAR trial, etc., I do follow this idea of high-risk patients that should be considered candidates for adjuvant therapy. Because we know that some patients with so-called stage 2 disease are actually do worse than patients with so-called stage 3 disease because overall survival curves are inferior. And this has been shown in various studies, for instance, that a patient with a T3N1 tumor might do better than a T4N0 patient, who by definition is only stage 2, and the other one would be stage 3. And this applies to colon cancer and rectal cancer, so whatever we turn and twist it. When you look at the MOSAIC trial, I think the MOSAIC trial had one interesting component which allowed us really to move things forward in clinical practice. The MOSAIC trial defined a high-risk group of patients according to clinical factors. And the appealing thing here is that these are factors every oncologist has at his disposal. It's the surgical report and the pathological report and clinical history. Was the tumor obstructing, perforating? Was it a T4 situation, undifferentiated tumor? How many lymph nodes were identified in the specimen? Because this has recently emerged as probably one of the most important prognostic factors for patients after resection of their colorectal cancers, the numbers of lymph nodes. Less than 10 or 12 lymph nodes identified, high-risk situation. So for all these factors, which does not require molecular assessment or whatever, which is being done in clinical trials right now, if one of those factors is positive, which in MOSAIC was true for about 2/3 of all patients, the patients were grouped into the high-risk category, and those patients benefited from FOLFOX with a 5% difference in, more than 5% difference in disease-free survival, and this is FOLFOX over 5-FU leucovorin, not over surgery. So if you really allow to kind of add benefits, you can say, okay, 5-FU gives you perhaps 3%, and FOLFOX gives you another 5%. So you're talking about 8% difference to compare to surgery alone for these high-risk patients, which makes it much more appealing and probably much more reasonable for to embark on adjuvant therapy in these high-risk patients. Having said that, when you now go the other way around and subtract the high-risk patients in MOSAIC from the overall group of stage 2, there's not a lot of benefit that's left behind for the low-risk stage 2 patients for oxaliplatin-based therapy. So this analysis has not been done yet, and we have no kind of pure low-risk stage 2 patient population which was ever prospectively randomized in clinical trials. But in my clinical practice, outside of a clinical trial, I tend to utilize these mentioned clinical risk factors to encourage patients to undergo adjuvant therapy. And then, of course, an oxaliplatin-based regimen.
The last presentation, what Howard Hochsker discussed, addressed this question. And actually, the next day at the ASCO GI meeting, Renee Adam talked about this, or at least the concept of neoadjuvant therapy for resectable liver mets. And the question we asked the audience was, the optimal non-protocol option for patients with colorectal cancer treated preoperatively with curative intent includes combination chemotherapy with bevacizumab and an anti-EGFR antibody. And about 1/3 of the audience agreed and 2/3 disagreed. What are your thoughts?
The question you propose relates to, should we use dual biologics as upfront therapy in a potentially curative situation? And we know that neoadjuvant therapy works best if we have the highest response rate achievable in a regimen, meaning we want tumor shrinkage for unresectable metastasis to become resectable. The question is, what's the best way to utilize that? And what's the best way to go there? In the absence of clear clinical data on combining EGF receptor inhibitors and VEGF inhibitor like bevacizumab with chemotherapy up front, I do not think this is, right now as we speak, the right way to go and should not be considered standard of care. I do see that EGF receptor inhibitors might play a role in the neoadjuvant setting for two reasons. First of all, we have clear evidence that the addition of cetuximab or panitumumab to chemotherapy, mainly cetuximab to chemotherapy based on current data, does increase response rate, which is what we need in the neoadjuvant setting. And we don't have any wound healing complication with the use of EGF receptor inhibitors, so we don't need to discontinue them 6 weeks prior to treatment, which what we normally do with bevacizumab. So it's easier to handle. So it could actually be the future of therapy. Combining cetuximab and bevacizumab is appealing based on the last line salvage therapy trial, BOND-2, which showed significant response rate. Having said that, we have not tested that prospectively in a clinical trial setting. We might not be able to go beyond a certain activity of chemotherapy up front, and so the addition of cetuximab or panitumumab to bevacizumab might not actually be better than just using chemotherapy plus one biologic agent. So for all purposes right now, as of early 2007, I think that FOLFOX plus one biologic agent approved bevacizumab would be the standard of care right now in a neoadjuvant setting.